but there's no effective sanction when they don't. And in instances where the money involved is either unknown or disputed, current language is ambiguous and could be interpreted to require clerks to make determinations about how much money is owing in order to satisfy a judgment. House Bill 2127 clarifies this by clearly stating that and setting out a procedure for how you deal with satisfactions in cases in which their money is unknown or in dispute. There's a process in the bill for requesting a hearing before the judge in order to obtain a satisfaction of judgment when a debtor cannot get the judgment creditor to satisfy it. The procedure is limited in scope, so it's not going to take a lot of court time. First of all, the judge can determine whether or not the judgment has in fact been satisfied, and if the judge decides that's the case, then the clerk is given instructions to satisfy the judgment. Secondly, if the judgment hasn't been satisfied, then the court can determine what amount of money needs to be paid in order to satisfy the judgment and instruct the clerk accordingly. At the request of a member of the House Judiciary Committee, we added a section here that would allow a party to recover attorney's fees and costs if the judge finds that the creditor's failure to file a satisfaction was willful. Those generally are the highlights of the bill. I've attached a section-by-section analysis and a hand-engrossed version, and will briefly mention the additional amendments we're proposing today. All of these amendments, again, were a result of suggestions made by the Bar's Practice and Procedure Committee. The first amendment would be to add a definition of what is a money judgment. Basically, we're suggesting that it be defined as judgments that require the payment of money, including judgments for the payment of costs or attorney's fees. Secondly, we're adding a clarification about a new docketing notice, and this is the notice that would be sent if a judgment is not docketed or only partially docketed, so that the party is on record and aware of the fact that there's a problem. The third amendment relates to Practice and Procedure Committee concern about Section 4 of the bill, which they thought set a subjective standard for court clerks in terms of deciding when not to docket a money judgment. And what we've done is deleted language that provided the clerk did not need to docket if the clerk was unable to ascertain the specific information needed under RCP 70. In conclusion, I'll just say that while this is a highly dry and technical area of court administration, it is a very important one for our clerks who are on a daily basis forced to deal with issues of judgments in the civil area, judgments which create liens on real property, which are of great interest to the litigants, and the process we've gone through with the various bar groups and other interested parties to refine this and get this in a shape everybody can agree to makes me confident to say that it will in fact benefit not only the clerks but everybody else who practices in this area or has an interest in this area. With that, I'll conclude my comments and entertain any questions the committee might have.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Hill.
I'm trying to in the testimony concerning the judge stating that the judge shall not sign a money judgment which fails to comply with the requirements of ORCP 78-2, if, however, the judge accidentally signs it, then it's effective. What's the point of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, that was an amendment that was made as a result of some concerns that the Council on Court Procedure raised. They felt very strongly that if the judge signs a judgment, whether or not it complies with the current judgment summary requirements or the new requirements in House Bill 2127, that judge's signature means that judgment should be docketed, and that the clerk should not have discretion to reject for docketing purposes something that has a judge's signature on it. We agreed to that amendment because it dovetailed smoothly with the requirement that we notify parties if there's a problem with the judgment. So that amendment was made in order to satisfy a concern the Council on Court Procedures had.
Okay, but it doesn't actually say accidentally signed by the judge.
No, it doesn't, Senator Hill. So a judge could decide knowingly to sign a judgment docket that was missing an element or two of the information we need to docket it. It wouldn't have been the way we had, it wasn't the way we originally drafted it, but it's acceptable to us.
Okay, as you say, shan't shall not sign, and then if you sign it anyway, it's okay. I mean, you really don't.
It's also recognition that judges occasionally will sign documents without carefully reviewing them, perhaps.
No.
Senator Grinsky?
Real briefly, with regard to costs and attorney fees, normally they're entered as part of a cost bill and are then part of the judgment. I see that you're deleting part of that and you're kind of redoing it down there on line 9, 10, and 11 in compliance with RCP 68C. So as a practical matter, once the judge enters a cost bill, is that going to be included as part of the judgment? And if so, how is that going to be done?
Madam Chair, Senator Grinsky, yes, it will. We originally had extensive amendments to RCP 68, but the Council on Court Procedures asked us to withdraw them because they plan to redo that section in detail in the next interim. So they would be entered as part of the judgment after the court has awarded them and would be enforceable.
Just like they are now.
That's correct.
Just different wording is all you're doing now.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks. That's all I have.
Are there other questions?
Me, yeah.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak to House Bill 2127? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2127. And we'll come back to it when we get the amendments and have a staff a few minutes to digest it and move on to that kind of issue. We've got one other person signed up who's come for public testimony, House Bill 2415. Let's take that, and then we'll move into our work session time. Mr. Kaiser, 2415. Oh, that's right. Marked in the wrong place. Well, okay, let's just leave this one over. We'll take a look at it, Catherine. Let's move then to Senate Bill 846. Yeah. Which it will take up where we left off, Jack, with the drug paraphernalia bill.
Okay, the amendments have been collated. They are back in your files, a paperclip behind the bill. There are some additional amendments that are a result of our discussions last night, and I'll go ahead and pass those out for you.
Now, I guess it's up to the...
Got an extra copy?
I guess it's up to the committee. Do you want the same folks?
Where do all these come from?
Jack, you'll have to lead us through these. Here we are, I have Mr. Bradley and Corey and...
Dan had to go to her son's getting an award or something at 7 o'clock.
Madam Chair?
Who is?
Rosanna Creighton.
Oh, okay. Senator Grinsky? Good question.
Never mind, no. Thank you.
Actually, I'm going to get another nasty note for a minute, and let's call on Steve Orgel for a moment to come on up, and who hasn't had a chance to testify last time, wasn't here the first hearing. This is a work session.
I appreciate that, Madam.
And if you could be brief, we'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Steve Orgel, and I'm a treasurer of a new group called Oregonians Against Drug Abuse. We are generally concerned about the problems of drugs in society, but we are very distressed by a quick solution in terms of increasing police powers at the expense of personal choice and freedom. I brought a few items I will save my remarks, except for a couple minor points, to written testimony that I will submit to the committee after the meeting. I wanted to show you an item, and I first want to ask the question of what the real intent of this bill is. If this bill is intended to stop drug use in this state or any other state, it will not. The evidence of paraphernalia bills in other states has corroborated that banning head shops does not stop drug abuse. It doesn't even make a dent in drug abuse or drug use. This is an item which you're familiar with. If you were to go the full route for the state's 300,000 marijuana smokers and completely ban all pipes, all bongs, all rolling papers, I could purchase this in a Safeway store, which I did for $1.49. Take one of the items, take the wrapper off the item. This is not what it appears to be. It's for demonstration purposes only. Seems that everything we put nowadays in a plastic baggie, peanut butter, jelly sandwiches excluded, appears like a CDS. It's actually something else. But I certainly, folks, could have no problem cutting this paper up into a piece that I could roll with, and it'll burn quite well. And I don't know if I need to take the rest of the committee's time on this particular demonstration, but suffice it to say that that is top quality rolling paper. So the question of stopping marijuana use with a paraphernalia bill is absurd. Now, I want to know, in general, we talked yesterday about intent on this bill. And I think that the committee answered a lot of questions and asked questions about the legislative language of the intent in terms of an item being intended for drug use. My question is, what is the intent of the drug bill pushers? Because as I have observed this current legislature in Salem, I have seen a spate of bills aimed at the drug problem, which, as the head of a group that is concerned about drug abuse, feel are totally missing the point on what the drug problem is. If we feel that adults are abusing themselves with substances such as marijuana, cocaine, and heroin, and then they have devices in a head shop, such as a water pipe, for example, which cools the marijuana smoke and makes it less harmful to this marijuana drug abuser to smoke, why do we ban a substance, an item, excuse me, that is reducing the harm to a member of our society? You see, it all comes from the notion of treating these people as criminals as opposed to treating them as people who should be classified as medically in need of help. And I think that a bill such as SB 846 has ultimately to do more with censorship than it does with drug abuse. The argument ultimately has to be made, ladies and gentlemen, about the freedoms that each American is guaranteed in this country. One of those freedoms is the freedom to choose responsibly. I want to point out Senator Springer has a bill, 936, which relates to tightening up the drug paraphernalia for minors. I think that is a good bill. I think that we are allowed in a society of responsible adults and citizens to be concerned about what our children are exposed to. I would like to see drug paraphernalia education in the schools. But when it comes to someone who is no longer a child, this bill is no different than a bill that tells me what book I can read or what movie I can go to. Do we, for example, ban the sale of camcorders and VCRs because we know that they can be used to make pornographic films in the home? Clearly not. We reserve that innate right of the adult in this society to have a private sphere and to make responsible choices. And I feel that any bill that it is stemming from an attitude of government knowing best and attempting to legislate morality is doomed to failure. And worse, I think what I'm seeing, and it's not just in this state, but I am seeing a trend in this country right now toward a quick fix, increase the powers of law enforcement, increase the penalties. You called it civil yesterday, but $10,000 for an apparatus that somebody sold like this that maybe secretly is designed to be a grow light or roach clips or whatever is to me an absurd penalty when we have stores that sell to anyone knives and guns. You amended the language of the bill to say items that are designed for use is drug paraphernalia, right? I remember hearing that amendment yesterday. Ladies and gentlemen, what is a .38 Magnum designed for to be used? To do heart surgery? Why are we not taking those people that are purveying those, and I'm not necessarily advocating we do, I'm merely pointing up an analogy here in your priorities. Why don't we take those people and slap them with civil penalties, the Smith and Wessons and the Remingtons, etc.? We feel that there is a constitutional protection for an adult to choose to use a weapon. And how that person uses the weapon is the person's choice. And clearly there are some sports shooting, for example, might be considered a responsible use of a handgun. So I think without taking any much more of your time, I mean, you've all heard this argument for many years. I think this bill should be dead once and for all. There's obvious drug paraphernalia items such as this, and I gave you a perfect example of an item. In fact, these are cheaper because I can get a couple hundred papers out of this pack for less money than I can out of this, that will do the same purpose. I mean, I have a film canister, right? It's for transporting here. It's got sugar, you know, to simulate cocaine. Here's the mirror I put my contact lenses in. I mean, I can take George Washington's picture on a dollar bill and snort the powder. What are you trying to accomplish with SB 846? Other than appeal to a drug bill-pushing lobby. A drug bill-pushing lobby that I heard testimony yesterday has to model its particular bills, whether they be paraphernalia or marijuana recrim or forfeiture or abatement. They have to model them after a national kit from the Justice Department. I think Oregonians should make law for Oregon and not let law be made by a Washington lobby. Thank you for your time. Any questions?
Are there questions? Thank you very much. Okay.
Madam Chair, I've spent quite a bit of time going over this stuff. It's important to all of us, I'm sure. I feel comfortable moving a few of these amendments. I'm not happy with all of them. I'd like to see if there's some committee support for them.
Okay. Are you looking through the 10-10 amendments? I guess before you start moving all of them, let's have Jack go through the ones the dash 10, the most recent packet, so we know if they fit together with what you're proposing. I'm not asking you not to propose them. I just want to get them all to see that they're fixed out.
The problem is you're risking confusing me, but that, you
know. No, right. We're ready.
Madam Chair, the new package that I've handed out to you that on the top is 846-10. The first dash 10 amendment is as a result of the discussion that we had yesterday. We heard testimony from Corey from the governor's office as well as others. This is the amendment that would substitute the term marketed for intended. I'm sure you recall we have some rather lengthy discussion on this issue and the reasons for it. On the next page, you'll see it's entitled Drug Paraphernalia Definitions. In handwriting, you'll see Corey 523 in the corner. These are definitions out of the United States Supreme Court Flipside case, which define designed for use and marketed for use. These definitions are provided, in a sense at least, and Corey can talk about this more, as perhaps an alternative should the committee choose to adopt one of the amendments we heard yesterday, which would delete the list of evidentiary factors. What follows is some excerpts out of the Flipside case. The next amendment you'll see is proposed amendments drafted by committee council number 2. This would insert jury trial language to make it clear, following our discussion yesterday, that a person is entitled to a jury trial. The next one, also drafted by myself, is a provision that would award costs and reasonable attorney's fees to prevailing party in any action brought under this bill. And then the final one is one that Roseanne handed to me just before the hearing. This makes two relatively minor changes. It would add in language, the office of it, so it would read the Office of Drug and Alcohol Abuse, and would also add in the term adolescent treatment. So I believe that's aimed at where the funding or resources would go.
Okay, Senator Grinsky.
Madam Chair, I don't feel that any of the amendments that have been proposed, 10 through et cetera, are going to do this bill any good. I think they're going to harm it. I think the very criteria that were referred to in the one amendment to be removed in sub 3 of section 1, I'm sorry, yeah, that's it, subsection 3 of section 1, are the very things that are going to make this bill either fly or not. That's the criteria factor. And the other amendments, such as the jury, that's going to be something the court can decide anyway, whether it is asserted in the bill or not, and other things are merely technical. I think we should try and preserve the bill in its present form as closely as possible to ensure it has some hope of getting through our court system. And I would like to move a few amendments here, if I could. I'd like to move the dash 9 amendment, the dash 6 amendment.
Okay, let's go slow here.
All right. Dash 9 amendment, of course, has the new section 5.
That's the seizure language proposed by Mr. Bradley.
The dash 6 amendment is a technical amendment.
So why don't we take them one at a time?
All right.
And have Mr. Bradley explain that dash 9 again and hear any response to that with respect to what this does or doesn't do to the bill.
Okay. Madam Chair, the reason this is put in the bill, as I indicated yesterday, was this is a civil bill. You have to have some ability to seize these things at some point. I drafted the three first sections out of the bill you're going to hear tomorrow, 2282, which is the forfeiture statute. And as I indicated yesterday, the one, if you had a judgment against the items, you could seize it on that basis. If it was pursuant to a constitutionally valid stop, arrest, or search, and that's where you take in the items, later you have to give them up. You could still hold on to them pending the outcome of the hearing in this case. If the owner or the person in possession consents to the seizure, or finally, if it's pursuant to a lawful order of the court, including an order issued under ORCP 83, which is a temporary restraining order. And the other language I have, ORS 166725, I call the Attorney General's office on that. That applies to the racketeering statute. The criminal and civil aspects of that, and they suggested to me that I include that in there. You'd have to violate the racketeering statute in order for that to apply, but once the racketeering statute came into effect, and if you seized it pursuant to the racketeering statute, you could then hold it pursuant to this section. But you have to have some authority to seize the goods you've got. Otherwise, you just have to leave them on the shelf until something was done.
Okay, what would happen if we allowed a personal right of action? Who would seize under those circumstances then?
If it would have to be a person going before a court and asking for a temporary restraining order, and I assume it would have to be something, there would have to be a showing that there would have to be a danger to health or other things. I'm not terribly familiar with temporary restraining orders since I don't get them in the civil area.
But I can understand how you'd want to do this if you had a government action or a district attorney or someone else coming in or a government official to do this. I wonder how you get there if you were a private individual, and I guess you're saying you'd have to come into court and say, I want to, in order to direct the police to go seize this? Is that how you do it?
Well, I don't know that you would direct the police to go seize it. I think you might have to, in some instances, direct the sheriff to do it. The sheriff is a kind of an officer of the court.
Yeah.
But there'd have to be, I believe, as there is with, and perhaps, I'm not going to say I'm an expert on civil law, but I believe, you know, they're entitled to a temporary restraining order, a hearing. But I'm just saying, and I assume that if the district attorney's office or the county council got involved, this may be one section that we would have to pursue under more than most, because in many instances there would not be arrests.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
Following up on your point, is the word seized a word of art, and maybe Corey can answer this as well, that applies only to law enforcement officials?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, I don't know if I can answer that. Certainly there are many circumstances in which a private party can obtain process which allows a sheriff to take goods into possession. For example, if I have a security interest in something and the person who owes me money doesn't pay, I can get the sheriff to go seize it back. But
a private person who wishes to pursue a private right of action, as this bill would permit, this couldn't be construed to permit that private person to seize paraphernalia, could it?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, again, I don't want to speak to this particular section because I don't know how it would work. I haven't thought it through. But the seizure in a private civil lawsuit between two private parties where the government is not a party and law enforcement is not a party, it is nevertheless possible to get an order directing the sheriff to go and physically take possession of a piece of personal property.
But at least you do have a law enforcement person doing the actual seizing.
It is the sheriff, as Mr. Bradley indicated, the sheriff as an officer of the court who would repossess an item or under normal provisional process take possession of an item.
Yeah, I guess if we take out the private party action, I'm perfectly comfortable with this.
Yeah.
Because that's where I am. Otherwise, it adds a great cloud, which I think is concern to me.
Madam Chair, I think it's not creating any greater rights as far as seizing property than currently exists. It just says that somebody has the right to seize things under this particular section. And of course, I'm still arguing that the private party ought to be able to intervene, and I would think they ought to be able to intervene with all the rights to try to stop. And I believe, and again, I don't get involved in temporary restraining orders, but I believe before a temporary restraining order can be issued by a court, there has to be a showing, doesn't there?
Well, how about forgetting about the TRO or moving from it, how about number one, that drug paraphernalia has been the subject of an earlier judgment in favor of the person. I assume that means the person seizing. So if you've had a private right of action which has resulted in a judgment, then apparently that person would be allowed to have the paraphernalia seized, which I guess is equivalent to an attachment, but I'm not sure that the protections that are available under an attachment proceeding would be available here. It might permit a sheriff, pursuant to that private right of judgment, to physically stop a person and take something from his person, which I don't think you can do with attaching under civil process. I don't think we'd want to go that far. At least I don't think I would want to go that far. I assume
that's
what you
intend.
That's
a policy decision the legislature
yeah.
has to make.
Yeah.
I guess the comment that I would have is this may be, and I'll throw in the same disclaimer that you have that I'm unfamiliar with, temporary restraining orders. But my comment is this may be an extension of that because, at least in my mind, temporary restraining orders are usually more in the nature of, say, a cease and desist order where you're directing the person to do or not do something, and this is of a completely different nature than that. It's not simply directing the person not to possess or distribute the items anymore. It's actually authorizing a seizure. So in that respect, at least, it seems to me that there's a difference there.
Madam Chair. Wait, I'm going to ask Cory to respond, and then we'll get to Senator.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure temporary restraining order is the correct.
The only time I know of temporary restraining order is domestic relations issues.
A temporary restraining order directs someone to temporarily do something or not do something. If we're talking seizure, the civil mechanism for seizing something is generally referred to as provisional process, and there are several different species of provisional process, attachment being one, and I've only done one in my life, and it was incredibly complicated, and I can't recite to you the different mechanisms. They are included in the rules of civil procedure. I don't know whether this is the correct cross-reference or not, but there is a process under which an item may be permanently taken into the possession of the sheriff and then delivered to the court or the civil party. It's not a temporary item. It's not intended to temporarily restrict disposition. It changes title, or it changes possession based on a court determination of title.
So it seemed to me that if we intend, John, to move beyond into the private party area here, we're going to have a lot more language that names out some of those things to deal with this. And I guess we need to have a committee sense of where they want to go with this. Maybe we ought to start in reverse order to settle things. First, Senator Grinsky.
I was going to say, Cory hit on it, ORCP 83 talks about provisional process, which temporary restraining order is only one form of that. Provisional process is a